Yes, well, this was a bit of a naughty one called Bare Hand by R. Rose. And before that, we had Bjorn Sveen with Sacrificial Dance remix. Mm-hmm. And before that, it was Andy Stott with Time Away. So it's a beautiful, quiet track that just gives me so much, I don't know, quietness and space. It's just, yeah. It's really for nighttime-ish, as per usual. And, yeah, let's go on with the next track. Also very beautiful, quiet one by a Singaporean artist called Chin, who I've played several times on the pod. And it's called This Is What You Drew While You Were Half Asleep. Here we go. Thank you.
My house and your house.
Thank you.
Oh, yes, that dubby feeling. It's just relaxing, isn't it? So, yeah, this was Paul, German guy, with a track called Silverfish. I mixed a record for a Finnish artist called Islaya, who used to live in Berlin, like me. And I was very excited to hear that Paul was gonna master this record. So, yeah, a little anecdote. And here's another Andy Stott track. It's called Leaving.
Thank you. My house and your house. Mit hus i dit hus. Mit hus i dit house.
Yeah, so speaking of, this was Islaya with the Pulpit Rising from her new album Angel Tape. She just played in Aarhus actually, and also at Fanø Free Folk Festival. Yeah, about to, you know, round this little session up. I hope you had some good experiences with your ears, that your ears were happy. And yeah, it's a joy and a pleasure to play music for you. I just love diving into all kinds of electronics and sharing them here on the pod. And so yeah, we are at the end of this episode. I just wanna play a little short one called Neurodivergent Gold Medal by me. That then goes into a Brian Eno track called A Clearing. I see you next month with new tracks for our ears, for our soul, for our mind, for our body. Goodbye for now. Thank you.
My house is your house. My house is your house.
Hey over there, what's your name? Are you for real? Is this a game? You start to smile and I do the same. I look away, but you remain. Your eyes staring back at me. My heart starts to skip a beat. I pray that you'll never know. I'm falling and you look in my eyes. You make me delirious. Next to me, you look at me, I find it hard to speak. I start to laugh and you do the same. I look at you, you smile again. Your hand holding on to mine. The thoughts running through my mind. I try not to let it show. I'm falling and you look in my eyes. You make me delirious. That's when I start.
Delirious is what I can't see. Something serious when it comes to you and me.
Taken their places now, and the joint committee will escort the president into the chamber in just a moment. Colonel Starling, the chief of the White House Secret Service, has been going up and down the corridor which runs off this House library, and we can anticipate that the president will be here very shortly. This is the 25th time that Congress has had a special session since its organization 150 years ago. John Adams was the first president to call a special session. He summoned the 5th Congress to meet on May 15th in 1797 to consider suspension of diplomatic relations with France. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison each found it necessary to call two extraordinary sessions, and Mr. Lincoln called another just before the Civil War. The greatest number of special sessions have been summoned by Woodrow Wilson and Franklin D. Roosevelt, three each. Mr. Roosevelt's first extraordinary session of Congress was in March of 1933 to pass emergency New Deal laws. The second was in October of 1937 to enact the social, labor, and farm legislation, and this special session that has convened today makes the third. Right now, the members of the House and the Senate are all sitting quietly in their seats. The galleries, as to be expected, are filled to overflowing, and standees are standing at all of the doors. The presidential box is directly opposite us across the full length of the House, and it's very hard to recognize anybody sitting in the box from here, but we can see some of the presidential confidential secretaries, Miss Grace Tully, and I believe Miss LeHand is up there, too. Outside of that, all of the boxes, right up to the very edge of the standing room, are filled to overflowing, and although the scene is not as bright as it was on the occasion of the 150th anniversary of the Congress last spring, the color is still there. There are many ladies in the audience, and they're all dressed in bright new autumn clothes. Colonel Starling, the chief of the White House Secret Service, has just come in the door immediately to the right of the rostrum and has spoken to some of the members of the Secret Service standing there, so we can expect now that the president will be here shortly. An hour before the scheduled convocation of Congress this morning and 3 hours before President Roosevelt's speech, vantage points up here in the galleries of the House where the joint session is to be held were taken over by newsreels and still cameramen. Even then, a few spectators with the coveted passes that entitle them to seats arrived. That was at 11 o'clock this morning. At that time, your reporter was here, and there were only two members on the floor itself, and they were Representatives Curtis and Graham. Both, incidentally, are among the few who have established perfect attendance records at the last session. Microphones were put in their places, and automobile parking in the plaza in front of the Capitol was banned. 2 hours ago, also, large crowds of spectators began to trek across the lawns and take up vantage points near the entrance to the House so that they might see the president as he arrived. Over on the Senate side, your reporter was there this morning, too, before this Congress was convened to hear the president's address. Vice President Garner was at his office very early, we were told, and was talking about his pecan crop and the bantam chickens in Uvalde, Texas, where he lives. A few senators, including Senator McCarran of Nevada, meticulously attired in a cutaway, strolled about the chamber. And the Senate gallery, strangely, were crowded, although the Senate's only task was to march to the House chamber to hear the president's message. Page boys, who had had their vacations interrupted by the special session, were making very sure that the senator's inkwells were filled and that pen points and pens and such things were in place for a busy week, or perhaps the busy weeks which are to follow. Now the House is sitting there in order, waiting for the president to come in, and we've just received a signal that the president has started down the corridor, which leads directly into the House itself. And we can expect Mr. Roosevelt to come through the door leading to the speaker's platform in just a moment. At that time, of course, the whole House will rise, and undoubtedly we will hear an ovation for Mr. Roosevelt. There always is one when he comes into this House to speak before the two sessions of Congress. Speaker Bankhead and Vice President Garner are presiding jointly, of course, over this joint session. As I told you, they are sitting together up where the speaker normally sits alone. That is a marble dais which is in back of the speaker's rostrum in itself, where President Roosevelt will make his speech. Up overhead, the sun is shining brightly through the glassed-in window, and we can see the famed coffin that is the speaker for the House amplifying system. And now Colonel Starling is coming through the side entrance to the House of Representatives, and President Roosevelt can be seen through the door going down the corridor with Secretary Early. Mr. Bankhead has just announced the President of the United States, and here's the ovation for the President. You can hear the ovation. Colonel Starling has just gone up and tested the Speaker's platform to be sure that it was sturdily built. And President Roosevelt, with the two committees, one from the House and one from the Senate, is walking slowly up the ramp. Now you can hear the shouts and the roar of the crowd as President Roosevelt starts to walk up towards the Speaker's platform on the arm of Brigadier General Watson, his secretary. Behind him is his bodyguard, Tom Qualters, And the two committees now are being conducted off the speaker's dais and back to their seats. Vice President Garner has shaken hands with some of the members of the committee, and both the Vice President and Mr. Bankhead are smiling and saying a few words to Mr. Roosevelt as he walks toward the speaker's platform. The ovation continues for the President as he stands there and now lifts his splendid head to smile at the crowd in his usual manner. He stands there quietly for a moment, and in just a minute now, President Roosevelt will begin his speech. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
I have the distinguished honor of presenting the President of the United States.
Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and the House of Representatives, I have asked the Congress to reassemble in extraordinary session in order that it may consider and act on the amendment of certain legislation, which in my best judgment so alters the historic foreign policy of the United States that it impairs the peaceful relations of the United States with foreign nations. At the outset, I proceed on the assumption that every member of the Senate and of the House of Representatives and every member of the executive branch of the government, including the President and his associates, personally and officially, are equally and without reservation in favor of such measures as will protect the neutrality, the safety, and the integrity of our country, and at the same time, keep us out of war. Because I am wholly willing to ascribe an honorable desire for peace to those who hold different views from my own as to what those measures should be, I trust that these gentlemen will be sufficiently generous to ascribe equally lofty purposes to those with whom they disagree. Let no man or group in any walk of life assume exclusive protectorate over the future well-being of America, because I conceive that regardless of party or section, the mantle of peace, the mantle of patriotism, is wide enough to cover us all. Let no group assume the exclusive label of the peace bloc. We all belong to it. I have at all times kept the Congress and the American people informed of events and trends in foreign affairs. I now review them in a spirit of understatement. Since 1931, the use of force instead of the council table has constantly increased in disputes between nations, except in the Western Hemisphere, where in all those years there has been only one war, now happily terminated. During those years also, the building up of vast armies and navies and storehouses of war has proceeded abroad with growing speed and intensity. But during these years, and extending back even to the days of the Kellogg-Briand Pact, the United States has constantly, consistently, and conscientiously done all in its power to encourage peaceful settlements, to bring about reduction of armaments, and to avert threatened wars. We have done this not only because any war anywhere necessarily hurts American security and American prosperity, but because of the more important fact that any war anywhere retards the progress of morality and religion and impairs the security of civilization itself. For many years, the primary purpose of our foreign policy has been that this nation and this government should strive to the utmost to aid in avoiding war among nations. But if and when war unhappily comes, the government and the nation must exert every possible effort to avoid being drawn in to the war. The executive branch of the government did its utmost within our traditional policy of non-involvement to aid in averting the present appalling war. Having thus driven and failed, this government must lose no time or effort to keep our nation from being drawn in. In my candid judgment, we shall succeed in those efforts. We are proud of the historical record of the United States and of all the Americas during all these years because we have thrown every ounce of our influence for peace into the scale of peace. I note in passing what you will all remember, the long debates of the past on the subject of what constitutes aggression, on the methods of determining who the aggressor might be, and on who the aggressor in past wars had been. Academically, this may have been instructive, as it may have been of interest to historians to discuss the pros and the cons and the rights of the wrong and wrongs of the World War during the decade that followed it. But in the light of problems of today, problems of tomorrow, responsibility for acts of aggression is not conceived, and the writing of the record can safely be left to future historians. There has been sufficient realism in the United States to see how close to our own shores came dangerous paths which were being followed on other continents. Last January, I told the Congress that a war which threatened to envelop the world in flames has been averted, but it has become increasingly clear that peace is not assured. By April last, new tensions had developed. A new crisis was in the making. Several nations with whom we had had friendly, diplomatic, and commercial relations had lost or were in the process of losing their independent identity and their very sovereignty. During the spring and summer, the trend was definitely toward further acts of military conquest and away from peace. As late as the end of July, I spoke to members of the Congress about the definite possibility of war. I should have called it the probability of war. And last January also, I spoke to this Congress of the need for further warning of new threats of conquest.